You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Welcome back, everybody, to HeadX. And I'm really pleased to be joined as a co-host on episode 101 of the podcast by Andrea Burrows in her role as MD of OES in the UK. Andrea, welcome as a co-host to the HeadX podcast.
Nice to see you.
Very nice to see you too, and to join you in this conversation and a series of conversations that we might have as the year gets underway now. I'm very pleased that we've always had a number of UK guests and international guests for what started as an Australian podcast on the HeadX show. We're going to have another UK Vice Chancellor today to have a conversation with us, and I hope we're going to get a series of those and other UK and international thought leaders in the weeks ahead. And I'm really pleased that you're going to join me as a co-host. We've known each other for a little while now. Looking forward to us leading the conversation together.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too, Andrea. And gosh, hasn't it been an exciting start of the year in terms of some of the things that are out there in the press? One of the things that really caught my eye, I don't know what you made of it, was when a place that I've commented on a lot in the 100 previous episodes of this podcast, Arizona State University and Michael Crow and his colleagues, seeing them sign up with OpenAI in the first strategic partnership that the owners of ChatGPT have formed with a university, that really sort of made my eyes open and think, my goodness, Pete, there's some out there that are really embracing this developing technology scene and generative AI scene. But look, I know much less about what's going on in UK universities and UK edtech than you do. This is your home patch. What is going on with partnerships between edtechs and universities in the UK? And where do you think that might be heading?
Look, I think the next 12 months is going to be a period of huge change. There's a word, kiki, in Japanese, which means crisis, and it's written with the words danger and opportunity. In other words, a crisis can be seen as a dangerous time, but equally as a time for opportunity. And we have a choice over which one we take. And I think that's really pertinent to the higher education space today. In terms of the OpenAI news and ASU, yeah, there's been so much hype about the impact on jobs and how universities are teaching, their organizational structures. I think Gen AI has grabbed the headlines. And, you know, if I think about in recent history, probably only the printing press and the internet are sort of the key developments that can compare with this. You know, ChatGPT was only announced about 14 months ago. So ASU's collaboration is really at the leading edge, but not everyone can or should be ASU. Not everyone can achieve that scale and ambition. And I would say, I think ChatGPT isn't the answer. It's the question.
What a fascinating way of seeing it and describing it. And look, you mentioned their crisis or opportunity. I sense from afar that there's more leaders of universities commenting on it being a crisis rather than an opportunity right now. We'll get to what Nick and Loughborough think. But the UK higher education funding scene is sounding incredibly challenging at this. You know, who knows what the political landscape for the UK government and any change of government might be through 2024 and beyond. But I'm sure universities must be seeking responses to crisis or opportunities that they can grab at this point in time. What's the place that technology is playing in any of that for the universities that you see? Is it core to their response?
Yeah, look, I think in response to your point about the financial challenges, I think for UK universities, it is incredibly challenging. And actually, it isn't clear what would happen if a major university risked bankruptcy. It has happened that smaller institutions have fallen into administration, but they're probably of a scale where the existing arrangements around student protection plans mean that institutions can merge or students transfer to another provider, not without impact, of course. And I think it's important to underline that. But I think there is a question, which is, could institutions take a more rigorous commercial approach to thinking about the tech investment, not just what they're buying and building or co-owning, but what they can invest in or work partner with others on? I think it's about really pinpointing the return on investment. And I think where we're likely to see the positive outcomes is where there's a financial entrepreneurship approach, which captures the benefits for the university. And I think that we shouldn't just assume that the testing and the IP and the financial benefit is only captured outside of the institution with the partner. I think that the vision of the VC and the collaboration with partners and the boldness to back the strategies that embrace tech are really key.
Well, boldness and vision of VCs. The most recent then, and the third of a series of stories that caught my eye, was one in The Guardian recently, where, ironically, I'd already set up this interview with their Vice Chancellor, Nick Jennings, but Loughborough University was being portrayed through a story as using AI avatars in lectures for channeling some expertise and content from MIT, channeling expertise and thought leadership from leading creative designers, and making that available to their students. I mean, how bold and visionary do you think developments like that are in the range of things that UK universities might have available to them at the moment?
Look, I think anything that's student-centric and engages learners and supports their studies is a great thing. I think there are some questions that we don't yet have answers to around governance, ethics and IP in respect of using AI avatars. But I think this is a great example of where institutions are harnessing technology. And if it works from the two perspectives of the balance of the institutional risk and the opportunities of financial benefit and the positive impact on the learner, then I think it should be embraced. Ultimately, risk appetite is a hugely important and under-discussed topic in the sector, and institutions need to probably think that through and take a global view, think about all of those things in the round. But I think that in terms of embracing new technology and trying new things, I think that's a great place for a university to be.
Well, a great place for a university to be, and a great place for us to pick up on an interview that I just conducted just recently with Nick Jennings, our VC. Let's hear what Nick had to say. I'm joined today on HeadX by Professor Nick Jennings. And Nick is the Vice Chancellor and President of Loughborough University, a university that I know and value very highly. And he was previously the Vice Provost for Research and Enterprise at Imperial College London. He was also the UK government's first chief scientific advisor for national security and Regius Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton. Under Nick's leadership now, Loughborough has launched a strategy of creating better futures together. And this strategy is guiding the university and sets out its purpose, its values and its aims. And it's articulating strategic priorities and recognising the impact of all of our actions on the world around us, and reflects the challenges that face us as a society. What a lovely way to start the year and start a conversation about the purpose of universities in the future. Nick, a very warm welcome to HeadX.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for having me.
And look, Nick, we could go on forever about all of the questions that I've lined up to ask you, and I'm sure you could tell us a lot about your personal story. But briefly, as a scene setter, what's been your journey into becoming a VC at Loughborough? How did you start off in life, and what got you here today?
Thanks. So I've been an AI researcher for my academic career. I got excited about computers when I was at school. I remember the day that our school had a first computer arrive at it. I'm of that certain age. And I was really fascinated by making it do things through programming. So I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Exeter. I got interested in artificial intelligence, you know, making machines do clever things. I thought that would be a really cool and interesting thing to study. That made me want to do a PhD and find out a bit more. So I went from Exeter to Queen Mary, University of London, did a PhD, started my academic career, sort of went through the ranks reasonably quickly, and became a professor in my late 20s. At Queen Mary, then moved to the University of Southampton Electronics and Computer Science Department, where I did the bulk of my my research. So I would say most of my important research happened while I was at Southampton. Latterly in Southampton, I became the government's chief scientific advisor for national security, which was a real privilege. Extended me in ways I hadn't quite imagined as a computer science undergraduate. Did that for 6 years, then went to Imperial College London to be the VP for Research and Enterprise. Did that for 6 years, and now 2.5 years ago, have landed at the University of Loughborough as the Vice Chancellor and President.
Wow, that's quite a distinguished and diverse tour through disciplines at the forefront of all of our current concerns, of course, and some great institutions. But I wonder, could you tell us a little bit more about what your personal journey has been, perhaps before embarking on that career, and anything that would help us understand what guides your approach in your philosophy, your values, and your approach to leading a British university at really these challenging times for funding, for purpose, for public esteem. What drives you in your philosophy and values in your work?
I've always in my life really enjoyed sort of solving problems, I think. So I've been interested in my personal research career in sort of taking difficult, complex problems and using advanced computing techniques to solve them. So a lot of my academic career has been about both the theoretical side, so I'm quite interested in solutions that you have a degree of confidence are going to actually work and actually do what you think they're going to do, and then their application to make the world a better place. And so some of the research I've done helped save lives in the aftermath of disasters, was used by Team GB to win gold medals in the Olympic Games, and has also helped monitor glaciers for climate change. So that making a difference is really important. And that's something I think has driven me throughout my career. I've worked with many different disciplines to build systems. So I'm interested in systems and their entirety, and sort of knowing that you can't just focus on one bit and tweak it a small bit over in a particular place and expect that the whole thing will get better. So I think that systems understanding, I think wanting to make society and universities really important and better is really what's driven me. And now I have a chance through a university leadership roles to help take that forward. Loughborough is a great university with real impact, and I want to take it on to that next level.
Well, I'm sure you are. And let's talk about Loughborough, having talked about you for a little while, because I've known Loughborough for many years as a very distinctive university, actually, with an excellent reputation in initially, as I understood it, quite limited fields, but great strength in STEM and the social sciences, very strong relationships with industry and partners, and a particular focus, you've mentioned GB sport there, a particular focus and reputation in the sporting area. But look, I'm probably way out of date in where Loughborough has travelled to by 2024. How else would you describe what is distinctive about Loughborough now?
I think that's not a bad characterization of our university. I think sort of coming here, there are a number of things I really noticed that I felt were distinctive. So firstly, our sort of campus, we're a big campus university. We've got our student accommodation on campus. And, you know, as a university that has got real strengths in sport, we have many sporting facilities. So colleagues who come in from America will say, actually, this feels quite like an American university or an American college campus. And that sort of shapes what we are. I think we're of a particular size. I think we're a really nice size. We're, by UK standards, you know, we're a mid-size university. We've got 20,000 students. And so that's enough critical mass to be able to be good at things and to really make a difference, but not so much critical mass that it's an anonymous place. And actually that friendliness is a really important aspect. I noticed both our staff and our students are really willing to help one another and get things done. And sort of that can-do attitude, I think, is something that's very striking. I notice it about our students, that, you know, they just get involved with so much, be that on a sports field or sort of be that in entrepreneurship or helping in the community, that really wanting to get on, do stuff and make a difference are the things that I really value and sort of noticed here.
You're using some lovely words there that connect with a current trajectory from Loughborough Built from Great Pass. And you've in your 2.5 years to date led the creation of Loughborough's new strategy, which goes by the title, as I understand it, Creating Better Futures Together. And in current circumstances where better futures for UK universities are more difficult perhaps than ever to imagine, I'm reading a lot about what's happening in the UK higher education scene. Not many people are using the words better futures at the moment in some of the commentary, I have to say. I wonder how you'd describe the current landscape for UK universities and what, in those circumstances, your approach is to ensuring that Loughborough is creating better futures.
Thank you. You're right. It's a challenging time at the moment in the UK. I think we're sort of challenged financially and in terms of the resources that we have by the structures that we've got in place. So sort of in the UK, the home student fee has been fixed for a decade. Not many of our costs have been fixed for a decade. And like many other universities in the UK, that leads you to greater internationalisation and a greater dependence on international students. And the current rhetoric in this country from our government is not very positive towards international students or even international engagement very much. And so that does make it quite hard to operate. I think we all accept that. And I think that's not a Loughborough specific thing. That's a UK university sector. I think my hope is that the UK universities are strong. You know, we have some fantastic institutions here in the UK, and that we will come through this and that we start to see those better futures emerging. And the other word, so after creating better futures, is together. And I think that's the really important part, and that's how we want us to be able to create those better futures. And together means internally to the Loughborough community, our staff and our students doing stuff together, getting things done, but also together means partnerships. So it means partnerships locally, regionally, nationally, and internationally. And sort of that thinking we can do things, we can do more, and we can achieve more by doing things together is a really important thread of our strategy.
Lovely. Well, very nicely articulated. And I didn't hear you in that articulate the many calls that I sense that are out there, perhaps more in the US environment, but also in some of the rhetoric around the UK and certainly in Australia, around the possible need for new business models and revision of funding models in our global higher education systems. Where do you stand on the issue of whether new business models would be part of the landscape for Loughborough's future?
I think you're right to observe that new business model, we all need to look at our business models, I would say. I think sort of the traditional models that we've all got are difficult to operate at the moment. So we're looking at a number of things. So we are looking at how we can get revenue from a diverse set of activities that we do. So we the revenue that we get from teaching and research, the other pot of revenue, is a decent chunk of what we do here. So we have some hotels on campus, we run a conference centre, we have sporting facilities. And so sort of that other part is an increasingly important part of what we want to be able to do. We want to engage in larger partnerships that I think will change the types of activity, the types of education that we do, and the types of research that we do. We haven't always been as out there as many universities. Our number of students who are international is about 16% at the moment, and that's reasonably low by UK standards. So we're not as exposed to changes there, but also I think that means we've not taken some of the opportunities. And so we will look at what transnational education looks like for us in a Loughborough context. We've not got a strong history of it, but I think sort of figuring out what we should be doing. We've mentioned earlier, we have strong connections with many forms of industry through our engineering connections and our sports connections and what professional development at various stages of lifelong learning might look like in those sorts of realms is things that we're starting to consider now as alternative and additional business model.
Fascinating. And look, we started this interview by you revealing yourself to be a computer scientist from way back and someone fascinated by AI before the rest of us knew what it was. I saw a recent article in The Guardian newspaper, I imagine you're across it, on commenting on the use of avatars for lectures in Loughborough, including representation of MIT professors and notable creative designers. And I read that pretty soon after I'd led the announcement of Arizona State University being the first global university to enter into a strategic partnership with OpenAI. I wonder if, set against those two bits of the most recent news, for someone that's been involved in this technology from way back, how are you seeing the current advances in AI technologies impacting the learning of students in a university like Loughborough, and how universities like yours and those elsewhere in the world might operate in the years ahead?
So it's really interesting at the moment to actually have worked in a discipline and to know a moderate amount about one of the most talked about, possibly overhyped disciplines that there is at the moment. And I would say sort of in all honesty, there's a lot of rubbish spoken about AI in terms of what it's going to do to society and what it's not going to do to society. And actually sort of I feel as a leader I'm able to speak with a bit of authority in this, having spent 30 years being an AI researcher. I think AI will absolutely make a difference to all aspects of university life. So I recently wrote a blog about AI-powered universities, and I spoke about the three main sort of types of activity where AI will make a difference. It's already making a difference in terms of research, and that's both in terms of new topics that are enabled by AI, so the ethics of sentient machines, for example, or computational creativity. These are genuinely new disciplines that don't currently exist. I think it will change the way that we do research. So lots of interesting work, for example, on sort of using AI techniques to find new types of drugs, to find new types of materials. So those are activities that are going on already, but will be made better by being AI powered. They'll be faster and able to do more. So that's the research. I think the organizations ourselves, the way we run universities is another area that's ripe for using AI technologies. I don't think we'll have an AI vice chancellor anytime soon. I very much hope that, however much our discipline might advance. But I think sort of as modern digital organizations, universities will be impacted by AI. You know, we use AI for HR, for our marketing, for our finance, because that's what the products in the market will bring us. I think in terms of education, it's always been one of the areas of AI that's always been touted as an area for particular focus. That ability to personalize interactions based on individual learnt experience. So almost like having an AI personalized tutor, that if you've got someone who can interact with you and knows what you like and the things that work well for you in explaining concepts, AI offers that. And we're starting to see some interesting offerings in that place. I think ChatGPT has put a cat amongst quite a few pigeons in the education space. And I think those universities and organizations who rushed to ban ChatGPT I don't think that's the way to do it. I think it's a tool, it's a powerful tool. We don't stop people using the web to search for material. ChatGPT is the same. We need to think about what's the correct and fair use of it. And that is not just cutting and pasting a ChatGPT prompt response into your essay. I think it'd be, we need to think about what assessment means, why we do it, and how we do it. And so I see lots of opportunities here for universities, research, education, and the way we run ourselves to be powered by AI.
Well, that was a beautifully succinct summary of 30 years of expertise applied to 2.5 years of leadership at Loughborough. But you mentioned a blog there, Nick. Is just for the benefit of our listeners, is there a source for that blog that they could read a longer exposition on some of that very succinct reply?
Yes, you can find it in Times Higher if I'm not advertising a rival product. You can also find it on my personal webpage at Loughborough University in a slightly different form.
Very good. The fact that you've got some open access on some commercial sharing of some of your knowledge is a very nice segue in some ways to the next area I'd like to take it. We recently had your, I must say, quite excellent colleague, Lizzie Gadd, on our podcast. And I learned through her commentary a lot about rankings and research assessment and research quality in global universities. I learned about a new initiative that she's spearheading and of Loughborough's innovative approach in joining in with that initiative of how to approach university rankings and how to portray a university's reputation and brand through more than what might be measured by whoever measures it as its rank. Can you tell us how you came to be involved in the More Than Our Rank initiative? And what you feel about how universities generally, and particularly like Loughborough, are adequately depicted or otherwise by rankings or might depict their differentiated position in other ways?
So I've always been interested in open science, you know, right from the beginning of my career when I was publishing stuff. I couldn't quite believe that people were happy to spend all that time and effort on writing really important results and then for not everyone to be able to see them. So I've always openly published my personal research. There's a strong ethos, I think, in computer science to use preprint archives and those sorts of things. And so I've always wanted, you know, I put the time and effort in writing something. I want as many people to read it as possible, right? So, you know, I've done something that I'm proud of, that I think has got a message that's worth saying. Why would I want to limit the number of people who access it? So I've always been interested in open science and open publication. And then sort of that, I think, led me to thinking about research culture. What's a positive research culture? What do we want to get out of our research environments? I've worked at a number of universities in the UK, each with their own sort of different cultures, I would say, but sort of trying to foster and develop positive cultures where good actions are rewarded as something I'm quite passionate about. So that's sort of how I got into that broad area of research culture. I've always worked in teams. It's the kind of science that I do. It's not sort of me just sitting in a darkened room on my own. I've always worked with teams. I've worked multidisciplinary teams. And sort of, I think that sort of people aspect and understanding and wanting them to get on is why there's a focus on research culture. I think the specifics around rankings are interesting. It's Loughborough has an amazing reputation in some areas. I'm going to quote a ranking figure back at you. So, you know, in one of the ranking tables, QS, we are ranked number one in the world for sports-related subjects. And that we use that fact and sort of we derive benefit from that fact. However, I very much feel that universities should not be defined solely by a number or a position in a league table. I think it's useful. I think it gives an indication of where strengths might lie. And sort of, if you're not an expert in the field, it's better to have something that is a guide rather than nothing that's a guide. I think about when I went to university or was choosing a university, I was the first in my family to go to university. So, you know, How did I know which university to pick? How did I know what was a strong university? Frankly, I had little idea, and you know, on reflection, I may not have made the most wise choices in terms of where I ended up, because I didn't really, I didn't know what I was doing. My choices were driven by reasonably arbitrary things, I would say. So I think they can help. I think understanding what they're good for and what they're not for good for is important, and I think that responsible use of metrics and innovation rankings is important. I think in some areas they tell you useful things. I think if that's all you focus on, then you're missing out. A university is so much more than the number in a particular league table.
Okay, thanks very much. And look, you've mentioned research quality and open research and open science in a lot of the start of that response. And you were previously head of research at Imperial College, which, whether you just have a feel for it or whether you read a league table and rankings, you'll have a clear view, I think, anyone would have, of it being one of the UK's leading research universities. Maybe it's well served by current university rankings, I don't know. But I'm more interested in someone that spent time at both Imperial and Loughborough in chancery roles, different roles for sure. How do you now see 2.5 years into your time at Loughborough that the two institutions differ? And how would you compare them in their story, in their mission, and what they're like to lead as community of learners and scholars? Are they different?
Like many things, I think there's some similarities and some differences. Some commonalities, I would say, are around quality of research and also wanting to make a difference to society and the planet. I think both Loughborough and Imperial have that desire to do excellent, high-quality research, not only for its own sake, which is perfectly respectable and good thing to do, but also for some of that to change society, change the way that we work, change the way that the business operates. So I think that sort of impact and partnership focus is very common to them. I think there are real pockets of excellence in both places, and sort of at the high end of what we have at Loughborough, I see broad comparisons to the quality of research that would be at Imperial. I think the big difference is the scale of activity. So Imperial really is a powerhouse of research. Well, interestingly, limited to a particular set of subjects. So it's a STEM and plus business set of disciplines, but sort of that real breadth and scale of activity, I think, is the thing that is a difference. And one of the things that comes with scale is I think some of the support and research culture pieces that we spoke about earlier. So the support that is offered that you can have for PhD students or postdocs or early career researchers, for example, is significantly bigger at Imperial because there are significantly more of those folk around, even in a given area. So, at Imperial, we might do things that were for a particular faculty because that's at a particular scale, whereas actually here in Loughborough, we do it for the whole university. So I see similarities in ethos. I see significant differences in terms of scale.
That's very interesting. And I don't know how it's playing out in the UK, but I sense a lot of my interviews of university presidents in the United States, and certainly with a big major piece of policy review in the Australian system following a change of government here some little while ago now, that there might be a view of there being vulnerability in research funding in the current funding climate. Certainly for all institutions that, by regulation perhaps, have in some ways been either required to or encouraged to, or maybe rankings is making it a necessity to be actively involved in high quality research and to be on a path to try and build that scale that you described that Imperial's already achieved and maybe Loughborough maybe it's on a path to trying to do it, or maybe it's not. I don't know. But what do you see as the issues in the current environment of funding and political and public views about research and science? What do you see as the issues for ubiquitous research intensity and ubiquitous research scale and excellence for every provider of higher education? Is that dream or aspiration still valid?
What we will see over the coming years is a greater degree of specialisation in the sector. So I can talk mainly from my UK experience. I think some universities will genuinely aspire and genuinely might have the resources and the capabilities to be excellent in research across every single area and every single subject that they do. That will be great for those. I think the idea that all universities should do that is a mistake. I think one of the joys of the UK system, so you know, circa 150 universities, is that they're all quite different. They're not all 150 versions of the same thing, just in a different geographical place. I think the missions that we have for different universities here in the UK are distinct, and understanding and playing to those is really important. Some will really want to operate at a massive scale on an international stage. Others will be very happy and best placed to help locally and regionally in terms of their research. And so I think sort of different scales of activity and different foci. I don't think everyone in all UK universities needs to be at the forefront of academic research. I think sort of recognizing that there are different roles within the community and different roles for different universities. I personally feel that if you're going to do research, you should do it well, and you should pick research that you can genuinely do well and genuinely be competitive in.
I can't help taking that lovely answer back to where we started this conversation in this interview, Nick, of your personal journey, and that when I asked you to describe your journey, you very much focused on your research career and the pedigree and the high quality of your personal research experience at a number of institutions, very high quality institutions by whatever way we measure them, and a really outstanding research career as the journey that you've taken to become the leader of a university that very much is involved in the game of research intensity, seeking greater scale and quality. But given your comment there about diversity and institutional mission, maybe you have a comment on this already being the case in the UK, or maybe you might see that it will become more the case in the future. What are vice chancellors going to look like in the future? If they're not going to be AI vice chancellors, are they going to be more different from each other in terms of their roots to leadership and their experience of research, or even of the academic enterprise?
Really interesting question. As you say, my route to the top is through research leadership, and sort of that's the way that I've chosen to get to where I am now. I see, if I look around the cadre of university vice chancellors in the UK, we get together moderately often. It's getting increasingly diverse, I think, in terms of the way that people are getting there and the types of people that are there. So I think sort of there are those who've come up, I guess there might be a slightly more traditional route for research intensive universities by being a moderately good researcher who's successful in what they do. I think you see people there who've got a real passion for education, for that student experience and engagement. I think sort of I personally feel the jury's a bit out on sort of those who've come up through the sector, through whatever bit of the sector that they've come through, as opposed to those who've come in from outside the sector. There's a nice mix, I think, in UK universities at the moment from an international perspective. So I have only worked in the UK sector, but there are now many leaders who've come in from outside, and I think that's a good thing. One of my abiding views in life is that the more different perspectives that you bring to a problem, the better the solution and the better the opportunities for learning. We've seen in the UK some examples of individuals who come from outside the sector, so outside university context, so, you know, business people or from charities, I would say that's still sort of, or from government, I still think that's a minority. I'm as yet undecided as to whether I think that's a good idea or whether that's successful or not. I think if you're skilled enough and know what you're doing, if you're a good leader, you can lead in that space. But I've also seen sort of others who've come into the sector from outside and struggle because they don't really understand what it means to be a university.
I don't know if you know Genevieve Bell as an AI researcher that's just taken over Australian National University after she's been running a tech company in Silicon Valley for many years before that. And will be a very interesting appointment for us in this part of the world to observe as a slightly different route. I guess my word of warning would be look out for the Aussies coming to the UK, perhaps, Nick. They're taking over your football teams. It might be some of their universities next. Who knows?
There does seem to be quite an international traffic, particularly from Australia, I would say. I guess there's a certain degree of similarity between the systems. And as I say, I think sort of different experiences coming into the UK sector can only improve.
Well, that's a lovely note to be optimistic about. And maybe just as a question to close, in the light of all that we've discussed here, Nick, it's been a fascinating conversation. I thank you so much for it. Is there some way that you might encapsulate what your vision is for a future for research and for higher education globally that we might expect to see as changes in the coming years? How would you sum that up?
I really am passionate about research making a difference to societies and to the planet. And I think sort of that trend that I've seen sort of throughout my academic career, where more people are interested not only in writing scholarly papers that are, you know, very deep and very thoughtful and really push the frontiers of their discipline, but actually those that can get out of a lab and really make a difference. You know, that might be in policy, that might be through a startup, that might be through a government organization or a charity. I really believe that universities can be genuine engines for innovation and improvement for society and the planet. And I think that global nature, those global collaborations that are required in order to make that happen are my hope for the future of our sector.
Well, what a lovely note of hope to finish on, and an excellent interview, a fascinating conversation that I've really enjoyed. So Nick Jennings, for being our guest on HEDX today, thank you very much for joining us from Loughborough.
Thank you, Martin.
Well, there we go, Andrea. That was Nick Jennings, the VC of Loughborough University. That point he made about whether we will see an artificial intelligence VC in our lifetime, and if not, what roles might AI impact most fully within our universities? Do you think we're going to see an AI VC in a British university?
Probably not in my lifetime, but never say never. This is a nascent concept. The reason why I don't think so is that there are social and ethical dimensions, as well as the complexities of leadership, that needs human intervention. The VC is a figurehead, the personification of the vision and the cultural norms, the unspoken, unwritten glue that really holds a university together. I think it's more likely that AI will continue to be a valuable tool to support decision making rather than autonomously taking on a role like that of the VC that really requires a deep understanding of human dynamics, values and strategic planning.
I think I'd have to agree with almost everything that you've said there, or not almost, but everything that you said. I've been reflecting over the break whether AI will replace podcast hosts and organisers of events in the future. That might happen in my lifetime, but I think all of these roles do have a significant place for the social and the ethical dimension. I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. And I wonder if I can use that as a segue to, you know, probe you to what do you see as the variety in which UK universities are embracing technology of the nature that you've described then? And I probed Nick a fair bit about how distinctive Loughborough was as a university. It's one that I know well from my past, a big focus on sports, a big focus on the campus experience, and a quite unusual history. Are distinctiveness in university strategy and history driving the way people are using technology in the way you see it?
When I talk to universities, I consider where they are in their digital fluency, where they are on the roadmap, probably also as well as where they sit in a university brand index. When I'm talking about a university brand index, you know, universities are more than a ranking. There are at least 9 key attributes that will resonate with students, and it's the combination of those attributes which gives the university their point of differentiation. Not every university can be number one in the rankings. Not every student will want to join a number one ranked university, nor will it be right for them. So I think to be distinctive is to understand the learner audience that they're looking to appeal to and own that space. So that clarity of vision, the quality of management and culture are 3 key aspects of a successful scale up. And in fact, referencing the report that was defined by Sherry Kutu, the scale-up report, which was commissioned in 2014 by the coalition government, and really looking as to what makes businesses, organisations successful. So technology is important, but actually, as I said, being distinctive in other areas and the clarity of the vision, which comes from the senior management, the executive board, I would say is critical.
I think you've really hit it on the head there again, Andrew. I mean, I reflect back on 100 episodes of HeadX and some of the different variety of people that I've spoken to. I there were 3 really notable American presidents of 3 quite different institutions, and they were Scott Pulsifer, Paul LeBlanc and Michael Crow of respectively Western Governors University, Southern New Hampshire University and Arizona State University. They've all had technology very much at the heart of the implementation and delivery of their distinctiveness. But certainly in the case of ASU and the other 2, the nature of their distinctiveness is quite different. And in every case, it's driven by a really bold and visionary and really influential leader in the way that you described. I think for me, as I look towards the future, I mean, you may know that we have a new vice chancellor of ANU in Australia, Genevieve Bell. A very exciting appointment in terms of someone that's come out of 10 years working in Silicon Valley for a tech company. I think I've got my 10 years right there. But also a recent guest from the UK that I know you know and the OES know well, in Alex Subic from Aston University, another university, another leader that has some very clear views about technology. I wonder how in future episodes, how we might uncover more of these issues as they play out in distinctive institutions and distinctive leaders in the UK. Any thoughts on that?
I think in simplistic terms, I would say 3 things. Think big, start small, and act quickly.
Well, what a beautiful note to finish on, Andrea. That's a very succinct way of summing up the issues facing leaders at the moment. And thank you very much for joining us in your first episode as co-host.
It's a pleasure.
And that's all that we've got time for this week on HeadX.